Session number 13271, Reel 7.
I was talking about the anti-slavery campaign in UK. Yes, the British seamen who manned the slave ships were often abused by their masters. And Thomas Clarkson found some of them half dead in garrets in the slave ports. And it was all part of his homework of finding out exactly how the slave trade worked. And he managed to get some of them out, nursed them back to health, and took them up to London and had them testify before parliamentary select committees, which I didn't know even existed in those days. And it was the publicity about this angle, above all, which swung public opinion round against the slave trade. And I see terrible parallels between that and the genetic deformities among the children of nuclear submariners. I don't think the British public are going to like it when they hear about monster children who have been allowed, first of all, to be born through negligence of the fathers in terms of their protective clothing. And it's going to be very different from just people dying of cancer who are ill. These are mutated children, and they are there as evidence. Hare lip, cleft palate, I know they're now quite old, but there are hundreds of these families, and they're so loyal, and they're frightened, and they don't want to speak out. And they have been suppressed, and it is an outrage. And I think this is going to stop the nuclear submarine industry in its tracks. So that is the other angle that I find myself involved in. And I find myself uniquely placed to be able to pursue this, because I'm so high profile, they can't touch me, but my God, they're touching the families.
How do you manage for funding? You know, obviously you're not thatching now.
Right. Yes, I omitted to say, of course, that I had to stop thatching in order to pursue the anti-nuclear weapon angle in the Gulf War. I wasn't earning very much anyway, thatching, of course. I do have my pension. I do have quite a bit of money left from Hilda Still, especially as, sadly, I split with my wife last year. And we sold the house in Dorset, and so it released quite a lot of capital. I'm living here with my father, who is very supportive. I'm effectively living here free. And so I'm able to continue. And we're getting some financial support for the World Court project through donations. And I have, in fact, got some quite big funding bids in at the moment, mainly to Quaker trusts. But I'm managing on that basis. But my father is really my financial anchor man. It is important to mention this business of finance because that is one of the reasons I'm able to pursue these horror stories about these poor families of nuclear submariners. I am financially independent. Okay, so I'm talking about the anti-slavery campaign and the parallels, and I believe that underlying all this, we are tapping potentially a deep well of compassion and fairness among the British people. And I think that this is still there, despite all the cynicism that has been promoted and the self-interest and greed of the last few years. And I am sustained by this. And I find going round the country, speaking to ordinary people, even people who are professionals, who are perhaps traditional Tory voters, if you have time to explain the problem to them, they're all concerned. They are worried about the future in terms of nuclear weapons. It is a jungle out there now. We've got to get a grip on them. How are we going to do it? And they believe that Trident is a mistake. But no one dare speak it. This is the emperor in his birthday suit. And the politicians, of course, are no help at all. And so you've got to do it without them. And this is why I believe the grassroots campaign on the World Corp project is so vital. And it's actually tackling a lot more than just the legality of nuclear weapons. And again, this is what sustains me. So I think probably that roughly explains that. But just to continue my little odyssey, having covered Japan in November, I then found myself in Ireland in January and again in March, lobbying the Irish government, and they are showing great interest. And they are a very unusual country. I was surprised to discover that they led in the introduction of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in the early 60s against enormous resistance from the United States and the British. And now they are concerned to keep their achievement intact. But it is under great threat now. It is potentially doomed, I would say, when it's due to be renegotiated in 1995. And unless some dramatic new initiative is introduced, either a comprehensive test ban treaty or what I believe is the alternative, or maybe complementary to it, that nuclear weapons are declared legal, I think it is going to go down the tube. And Ireland is, of course, neutral, not a member of NATO, but a member of the European Community, under great pressure following Maastricht to come in under the new European Community Defence umbrella, which involves, if we're not careful, an Anglo-French bomb. They are very interested in the World Corp project. And I had the wonderful experience of meeting David Andrews, the Minister of Defence, who actually said, despite being Minister of Defence, I think all weapons are abhorrent and nuclear weapons are obscene, and I therefore would support anything to help get rid of them. And I feel that there is a good chance that they may even co-sponsor this resolution at the last minute when it comes to the General Assembly at the end of the year. But they are being heavily pressurised by the NATO nuclear powers. And this is what brings me to my latest trip, which was to the United States and to Canada. I was, again, wonderfully encouraged by Canada. Despite being a NATO member, the ordinary people are definitely anti-nuclear. But one of the things I discovered was that at one stage, back in the early 60s, Canadian starfighter aircraft in Germany were involved in nuclear release. They were actually earmarked and went through the drills of carrying free-fall American nuclear weapons. I'm not sure how many of the Canadian people knew that, but even more fascinating was that I think in about 1970, Pierre Trudeau quietly said that they were no longer going to do it. And they stopped and got away with it. And so I, having discovered that in Canada, was going around talking about it. But I found great support for the World Corp project in Canada, even among politicians. I also found great support among the churches, not least the Anglican Church. And, of course, the Anglican Church is tragically sucked into blessing the bomb in this country. And I've had a desperate response from the Archbishop of York, and the Archbishop of Canterbury won't even see me about this because they are locked into the establishment and they have had to bless the bomb. So we have difficulties there. Having said that, the World Anglican Communion met in Cape Town in January and passed a resolution endorsing the project. The Archbishop of Canterbury was there. He's been trying to dodge it ever since. New Zealand Bishop Synod has just endorsed it. British Columbia, I think, is about to endorse it. You know, and so it's happening all over the world, but we can't do it here. And I have found that, in my experience, Russia and China are both abstaining vis-à-vis the resolution concerning the World Corp project. Our lobbying team in New York is finding this. They are waiting and watching the nuclear powers in NATO. And it is the United States, UK and France who are holding out. And it's all to do with permanent membership of the Security Council and all these other things about being at the negotiating table. It is all completely bogus and, in fact, completely counterproductive that I believe that the first nuclear power to reject nuclear weapons could claim moral leadership of the world and will be forgiven for doing so. And there you would have real world statesmanship, the sort of thing that our leaders have fooled themselves into believing the bomb would provide. And it's just a prop for weakness, in fact. And you are sucked into behaving like a terrorist. So, this is what we've got to somehow get across to the British people. And as I say, I am encouraged by my meetings at grassroots level. And gradually we're beginning to find politicians who are prepared to come out of the woodwork. And recently there's been something of a breakthrough. We have an early day motion being tabled, I think, next week in the House of Commons. And Sir David Steele has said he will support it. That is a big breakthrough. I don't know whether Paddy Ashton knows about that, because Paddy Ashton won't discuss the bomb with me. I think that brings me roughly up to date with the World Court Project, except that I would also say that we have now had a breakthrough at the World Health Assembly last month in Geneva, which is the annual get-together of the World Health Organization, which is a major UN agency. The doctors managed to not only get a resolution tabled, but it went through by a big majority for the World Health Organization to ask the World Court for an advisory opinion on the use of nuclear weapons with respect to their health and environmental effects. This was despite heavy strong-arming against it by the three NATO nuclear powers. And I think one of the reasons it went through so well was that it was a secret ballot. But we are much encouraged by this. We are now being taken extremely seriously, not least by the British government. I had a most unpleasant meeting with the legal advisor to Sir David Hannay in New York just 3 weeks ago, in which he said effectively that the gloves were now off, that they would, of course, oppose this resolution as they were a nuclear power, that as far as they were concerned, nuclear weapons were legal, and that if the World Court was unwise enough to rule against this, they would ignore it. And then he came up with a very strange statement. He said, if we have to argue this in the World Court, we will cite Dresden in our defence. I was fascinated by that, and I thought, well, now let's do this. Let us at last have a debate in the top court of law in the world about Dresden. And maybe the World Court will come out and say, yes, that was illegal too. And there is, of course, a seamless line to Hiroshima from Dresden. And I suspect the United States will be very unhappy if the British try that argument. Because we now know from our lobbying team that the Americans are openly saying they're going to block this resolution because they fear being taken to the World Court for Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And then there is the question of testing, which of course is use. And all these things, I think, are coming together, and I think maybe the time has arrived for us to have a proper legal discussion and let's thrash all this out. And incidentally, we have no intention of pillorying the United States for Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We believe that there were enormous pressures on them at the time, and then the project itself just got its own momentum. It was so powerful. It was so big. It was the biggest thing since the pyramids, I believe. And it was so secret. And there was the Japanese atrocity problem. We do not want to go over that. We want to sort out the present and the future. The world has changed, and let us take this chance peacefully to resolve this problem and get a grip on this terrible menace to humanity. And we're going to have to try to hold the hand of the Americans, who are the biggest nuclear junkies of them all. And they very much have got to be treated like patients, I believe, as we take them through withdrawal therapy. And I believe that the whole approach has got to be that they should try to relax and understand that if they drop their guard in terms of nuclear weapons, they will not be incinerated 2 hours later, and that if that, therefore, they can get through that, then we can perhaps bring these things back alongside, like Polaris, take the weapons off, put them in a store, and then begin to wind down this ridiculous hair trigger situation that is persisting at the moment, purely through ideology. And one of the things, if I may come back to the British submarine safety problem, that really worries me, is that I understand that the reactors in the Polaris submarines, which are very old now, have got these hairline cracks in their coolant systems. But whereas the attack submarines can be brought alongside and sorted out, we've got to have one Polaris submarine on patrol continuously because the ideology dictates that. And therefore there is this great risk that there will be a malfunction. For what cause, I ask? It is outrageous that we should have this continuing. And that is another reason that I am motivated to continue in this campaign to get that put right. Example that I would like to quote, which illustrates how the church has been seduced or cajoled by the politicians into supporting their nuclear addiction. And that is the way they have been required to bless the bomb. I have here an extract from the first recommissioning ceremony of HMS Resolution, Britain's first Polaris submarine. And this is towards the end where the chaplain is blessing the ship. And he says, "Go forth into the world in peace. Be of good courage. Hold fast that which is good. Render no man evil for evil. Strengthen the faint-hearted, support the weak, help the afflicted, honour all men, love and serve the Lord, rejoicing in the power of the Holy Spirit." Now, for me, that is deep abuse of the Royal Navy's duty when they are actually talking about here a nuclear warhead ballistic missile firing submarine about to go out on its first patrol. And I see it very much in the guise of "forgive them, Lord, they do not know what they're doing." But it is that sort of thing which causes us such difficulty now with the church, who feel they can't come back off the limb. I just wanted to mention that.
You obviously still have great affection for the Navy.
Oh yes, I really do think it's a good institution. I know it's had its bad moments, but I believe it has done a lot of good in the world. I believe it has, particularly in the time that I was in it, begun to really develop its humanitarian capabilities. The helicopter, above all, in which I was deeply involved, has done an awful lot for good. And I see its future as being very rosy in terms of disaster relief, other humanitarian tasks, peacemaking, peace building. I mean, the British sailor has always been an excellent ambassador for Britain and taken it very seriously. And the British warship is a very fine way of projecting the country's best qualities abroad. You don't, of course, have any nuclear submarines doing this, really, well, not effectively, and certainly not Polaris. It has no part to play in that. In fact, it undermines it. And Trident, of course, is absolutely disastrous in that respect. And worse than portraying the wrong image, it's actually undermining the ability of the Navy to be able to be a good ambassador, because it just won't have the other ships. And the whole ethos of the Navy, I fear, is threatened. If I could give you an example, I was about to start a public debate in a hall in Bournemouth a couple of years ago when a woman rang me to say she couldn't make the meeting, but she was very worried because her daughter was about to join the Navy, and that if I argued against Trident, what other role was there for the Royal Navy. I mean, that really horrified me, to think that this mother was actually concerned that the only role that the Navy now had was Trident and Polaris. And that rang the alarm bells for me.
Yes, given your, you know, respect and feeling for the Navy, and you have mentioned earlier, you know, the trauma of sort of coming out and speaking out against these things, you know, could I follow that up a bit? You know, how traumatic was it? You know, for instance, speaking, I think you said, to a crowd of 20,000.
Oh, yes, and it was doubly traumatic to be doing it from the foot of Nelson's Column. And I did wonder whether I was the first ex-commander to have ever done that. I was told a little while ago that, in fact, I think there was one before me, and that was Commander Sir Stephen King Hall, who was very prominent, apparently, back in the 30s. He was an ex-intelligence chap and got involved in radio and things and was certainly anti-nuclear and did, I think, speak once from the foot of Nelson's Column. But I, in fact, felt that I had to invoke the immortal memory of Admiral Lord Nelson while I was there. I think it was lost in the crowd, in the noise. They were heckling me. By then I was spoken too long. But I remember saying something like, I cannot resist invoking the immortal memory of a former commander-in-chief of the fleet, and sort of pointed upwards. And I did have a point to make. I said that, as far as I can recall, it should not be forgotten that although this square celebrates his greatest victory, he personally conducted a strategy of economic sanctions off Toulon against Napoleon for 2 years. 2 whole years. An admiral sat out there. And the only people who complained were the French and Lady Hamilton. And I think it was lost on the crowd. But, you know, that was my feeling about it at the time, that we don't learn our lessons from history. And here was a lesson directly from the chap who was on the column above this crowd. And I actually believe that Nelson would have thought that was a rather foolish way to go about solving this problem. I also had every confidence that Nelson would not have believed in Polaris, because, and of course Trident, because of the damage it would do to his beloved Navy. But you asked the question about the trauma. Well, of course it was deep. I wasn't joking when I said that I feared a snatch squad would come out of the crowd. This is the sort of thing that one had to go through. And I knew that I couldn't really contact my former colleagues because I would be dragging them in, although I have had some sympathetic messages from a few of them. And incidentally, one of them I did meet in the street. And he said, oh, I see you're campaigning for peace now, Rob. And I said, no, not for peace, for a sensible way to solve this problem. And, you know, we couldn't really discuss it anymore. But this is the difficulty that I feel. The sort of nuclear lobby has got a grip on the whole debate, and I do feel seriously that they are able to stifle the debate. It's self-censoring, a lot of it now. And so we have a real problem in trying to break through that and get people to dare to discuss it even. Because when we do, people are remarkably responsive. And again, that's what actually keeps me going now, is that I have met people who I would have expected to have tried to rubbish me, and they don't. They are seriously concerned, and they think I'm right. But they can't talk about it openly, because it is heresy.
If I can follow up, you know, the response to your colleague's statement, are you a pacifist?
I have a feeling that probably I have always been one. And I've never been any great sort of strong guy physically. And so I have always had to find my way around without using force myself. I've never been a great boxer or anything like this. And I've never been particularly interested in weapons. And I have, of course, this very unmilitary family background anyway. So I feel actually that my subspecialization as observer, incidentally, is a very accurate way of describing how I've been through the Navy. I feel detached slightly because of the lack of, you know, sort of tribal links. And I almost found myself looking at the Navy towards the end like an anthropologist who goes and lives with the tribe to understand them better. But I felt myself not one of them towards the end. My values were clearly too sensitive and beginning to diverge. And then there was the Mrs. Thatcher problem and then my whole difficulty because of my aunt's work. And so I began to sort of drift away from it. But I see myself as a nuclear pacifist. I don't think that I could actually openly campaign for total pacifism at the moment, especially with the problems with Bosnia and Somalia and everything going on. I do believe that there is a justification for controlled force. And incidentally, a lot of people ask me, what would you do about the situation in which a madman or terrorist has a nuclear bomb and you don't? How do you sort that out? And my answer to that is, I certainly wouldn't use a nuclear bomb against that problem because it solves nothing. It just exacerbates it. You just also get into the same mentality as the terrorist and you're playing into his hands. I would advocate the sort of solution that was used by the French in that incident a few months ago in a school in which a madman with a gun and with explosives strapped around his body took over that young primary school. And what did they do? They wore him down over time. They took great care not to provoke him in any way. And then when they had worn him down, they sent in special forces with silenced pistols that really did surgically take him out. I believe that was an efficient operation. And I'm actually coming round more and more to feeling that the only people who almost should be given the job of operating militarily are special forces. But you come up against the great difficulty of how you control them because they're so secret. But that to me is the only really controlled use of force by very highly skilled and highly trained professionals. And I just fear that with the hugely increased explosive power of these new weapon systems as we've witnessed in the Gulf, that there's no such thing anymore as surgical use of military power. And you're down to small arms and highly trained professionals. I think Noel has just arrived.